Buffalo gal, won't you come out tonight? Come out tonight, come out tonight. Buffalo gal, won't you come out tonight and dance by the light of the moon?
Good morning. This is, it's afternoon now, isn't it? On day three of the 4F convention here in Batavia, New York, just outside of Buffalo, which is why you hear the Buffalo Gals music on the rest of this podcast. But from England, living now, I guess, in Florida, we got Bob Swadling. Hey, Bob, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
So tell me something. You've been coming to 4F for what? This is your seventh or eighth year?
How many? Yeah, something of that.
Something like that.
Yeah.
How did you first hear about the 4F convention?
Obi saw me work in England, mm-hmm. and said, would I come over and lecture and do the close-up show?
Right.
And I did that. It wasn't held in Batavia. It was in I don't know where. But they had line dancing downstairs.
And, oh, okay.
I don't know where.
I remember that would have been the brew house, I think. In,
right.
Yes.
Yes. And mm-hmm. I enjoyed the line dancing. I'd never done that. And so then every year from that, and I've lectured here again, and I've taken part in some of the shows. And my main reason for coming is to meet with old friends. I don't really care about the matter to that degree. And I'm very sad now because the people I used to hang out with, that would be Herb Zarrow, Ace
Greenberg. Oh, Ace is still around.
Yeah, but he's very ill. He's got cancer, and he's very, very ill. And Howie Schwartzman.
Howie's not doing well. He's not here this year.
Yeah. He's not here. So these people who I hang
Ali
out
Bongo,
with,
used to come here.
Ali Bongo, and my good friend Pat Page, and I think I said Herb Zarrow. It gets a little more difficult, a little bit more difficult for me to... I see their pictures on the wall.
Sure.
Because they've all been...
honored as guests of
honor.
Honored
guests of honor, most of them. And have a little tear, really, because the beauty of magic for me is the wonderful friendship that you get. And this convention in particular... say I wanted to learn the Zarrow Shuffle. There he is.
There is Zarrow. There's Herb right there.
And he's such a kind man, and he spends hours. I wanted to learn. Pat Page was a very good friend of mine. I used to spend an hour with him every year here in his room, and he tried to teach me cutting to any card.
Yeah.
And I was hopeless. I mean, absolutely hopeless.
Okay.
But he's just put out as you know, he's dead now, and his family, before he died, Pat wrote this book, and his family have put it out. And to me, the magic in there is stunning. He's got the cutting to any card, which I'm still working on. And so it's very happy memory book for me, same as Herb Zarrow with his book. So I can still go away and read and bring back happy
memories
of the people.
I think you've hit on a good point there, Bob, as far as how giving and caring and much of a fellowship that this particular group is, as opposed to when you go to some other conventions. And I think it's because that everyone respects each other's skills. I mean, there is a certain level of skill, obviously, that people have, which is a high degree, and sometimes at a general convention, if you will, it's as if that they don't want to give away stuff that people aren't going to be using. Here, they know everyone respects it. They have come up with these ideas. You talk about Herb Zarrow, for an example. One of the first conventions I went to at the 4F many years ago, there was a guy, Dave Letterman, that's D-E-L-E.
Yes.
And I was doing this card trick, and at the bar, you know, he was sitting there, and I was showing him, and he said, well, the way that I invented it was like this. And I said, this is called Dave's Delight. And I looked at his name tag. Said, oh, you're Dave Letterman. Like, holy cow. That's when it first struck me. All these guys are the ones who came up with all the ideas that I'd been using and playing with, you know.
No, I think it's the friendship is... and what is different, I think, is that now at major conventions, though the numbers are dropping off, but at major conventions, if there's a lot of magicians there, you don't meet them. You, mm-hmm. Gosh, did you attend that? I never saw you there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And also the sessions here, where Obi's got that room upstairs.
Right, hospitality suite, yeah.
And there they are. I mean, and everybody's right. Doing something,
around
sharing
the table,
something.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's, and to me, that's wonderful. Where else? I don't know of anywhere else in the world. And Obi, I laughed at Steve last night, the guest of honor.
Ragazzi, yeah.
Because when he said you're invited here, it's really special,
yeah.
And you don't get paid.
Yeah, you don't get paid. He said, yeah, how much am I going to be getting?
Yeah,
what?
Yeah, you're getting nothing. And you could see, I've known Steve, I mean, I remember when he came with, he had that serious accident and his leg was all in plaster, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
He still, with his mate, did the funniest thing.
Yes, yeah.
The other thing is, normally there's a magician that I like, was Rocco.
Mm-hmm.
And Rocco used to, I don't think he's here.
Not yet. A lot of times he'll show up on Saturday or afternoon
okay.
or something. So
oh,
he
right.
may yet be here. I didn't see his name
all
on
right,
the schedule.
Because
though.
He is... He puts together every year something really special.
He does, just for this convention
just for
only.
Just this convention, yeah. Only does it the once. And so,
and
where else,
things,
you know,
yeah.
Where else in the world would you see that? And I also have to mention Obi and Joan Caesar, really, for keeping this going. It's not an easy task. I don't know what will happen when Obi, you know, passes
that, yeah.
on or whatever, but it'll be a tough act to follow.
Yeah.
You know, so...
Yeah, it's gotten larger by having, you know, international talent that has come. I spoke with Obi yesterday, and he was saying how that he and Joan will be... judges in different international competitions, so they get to see some of the best, and that they
yes.
will then offer, you know, them
yes.
to come here. So it has gotten to be, what do we got, like 17 different countries represented, you know, here this year. So
yes, it's nice to see the people from the Asian countries, and they're all first class. I mean, mm-hmm. the Japanese and the Koreans, and I think the Koreans now are... got some of the best in the world.
They do seem to be very great.
Good,
now, you being from England, you moved here to Florida, is that right? Just how long ago have you been?
3 years Christmas.
Okay.
Why did I move here? My daughter, who was a magician, one of the best. She's one of the few who are Gold Star members of the Inner Magic Circle.
Hmm.
And she was used to be flown over by Michael Jackson to do private parties, and she was a top magician. She married an American, moved over here, and she had twin girls who were 8 years old a couple of days ago. And so we came over to see the... to see the girls grow up.
Right.
And it's been wonderful. We've seen their first school play. they belong to the Orlando Children's Choir. And one of them is a fantastic gymnast.
And you get to be a part of all that.
And we get to be part of it all. And it's just wonderful for me. And I must mention the magician. You have to remember, when I came over here, I only knew my family.
Okay.
Nobody.
Mark Mason wasn't here yet?
Yes,
or?
Mark, but I didn't know he was here.
Okay.
And they heard I was here, and they asked me to lecture down at the Bed Bergeron IBM room
mm-hmm.
in Orlando. And they were made such wonderful friends, made me so welcome, that the IBM, to me, I mean, I've always been an IBM ring member.
Mm-hmm.
And the hospitality, the friendship, it's been wonderful. And in Orlando, we have a small theater, we call it, called the Wizards Theater.
Right.
And every week...
Eric Olson?
By Eric Olson. And I'm big friends now with Eric and his lovely family. And and also made friends with Mary and Jack Caddell.
Yeah, because Mary was from England, as I recall. Mary Caddell was from England. She was a dancer, as I recall.
No, you have
Is
to...
That right?
That's being too modest. Mary, the London Palladium is the biggest variety show in the world that you could play at that time. And Mary was on there at 12 years old, on the London Palladium. And the names won't mean anything over here, but she was brought up really with Morecambe and Wise and the top stars. And she had her own big TV show.
Yeah.
And gave a start in her show to many of the singers and things that went on to be big stars.
Yeah.
And what Mary doesn't know about dress, how to look on a stage. She's in her 80s now, and you wouldn't know it. She carries herself
very well.
Now, Jack...
Yeah, Jack Caddell died just
yes,
this last year.
I got to know Jack very well, and I respect him. He never passed on how he did anything in his act. He let me know a few little things. He advised me. He was quite critical, but helpful critical. You know?
Right.
So, and I was very honoured to be asked to do a comedy bit at his memorial service.
Nice.
Mary asked me to be as rude as I could because she hated the thing. And John Eakin and the lads, Terry Ward was his best friend. And so I've had very... And we all go round to Mary's house after Wizards.
Yeah.
And she's a wonderful host.
Mm.
And we sit there, everybody telling lies and big stories, how famous
they
are.
Early in the morning, yeah.
And she puts on food and a drink. And so where would I have been coming over here if I hadn't had magic?
Now, you're very well known for making coins. I guess they're not called swaddling coins, are they, necessarily? But you have flipper coins, other kinds of stuff that you manufacture. How did you start getting involved in that and then get connected with Mark Mason and all? That's a long story, a lot of...
Well, it may be too long.
Okay. Just the short version here.
Just the short version. Yeah. Okay. Ken Brooks, who was my best friend in magic, he put an advert in the trade paper, a magazine called Abracadabra. And there was a Dutch magician called Mark Anik, who put out a coin trick called Mark Anik's coin trick. And Ken Brooks said, if anybody could make a better trick, the coin trick than Mark Anik's, he would pay them £50. Now that was a real big lot of money.
Yeah.
So I made a coin trick.
Okay.
It was Mark Anik's coin trick.
Mm-hmm.
Mark Anik's coin trick, you could only do the once, and that was it. You couldn't do it again. You had to go away in the cupboard and reset.
Yeah.
Mine, you didn't have to reset. So I said to Ken, I went and showed it him, and he said, Bob, that's Mark Anik's. I said, well, I'm not sure. I said, I'll show you again. He said, you can't.
Got to go set up.
So I did it again. Whoa. He gave me a 10-shilling note.
Yep.
And he signed it, Ken Brook.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm saying, well, where's the £50? He said, you make me 50 of those coins for Blackpool, and you'll make money. So that's what I did.
Okay.
And I made money.
Yeah.
And after that...
What year was this?
I can't honestly remember. A lot of people ask...
10, 15, 20, 30 years ago?
I mean. Oh, more than that. I'm 73.
Mm-hmm.
So I must have been in my 20s.
Wow, okay. Didn't know it was like that long ago.
Yes.
Okay.
So, and then Ken said, could you put... What it was two... I think it was the first time it had been done. It had magnets enclosed in coins. And Ken said, could you put them in an English penny? Now, that's very thin compared with the other one.
Mm-hmm.
And I won't bore you with it, but I had a contact who could make the magnets very small. And nobody else could. I knew the managing director of the magnet company. And so I made these coins, and it were two magnetic coins, two cards with different size thickness shim in, and Ken put it out as a swaddling swindle. And it caused a bit of a sensation, and so that was... And then the next thing really was a little trick called Blasted, which is where you have a small tray.
Oh, sure. And a little die?
No, you have two coins.
Okay.
And you put one on the tray, you cover it with a glass, mm-hmm. you put the little coin on top and you press, and the one on top disappears and appears inside.
Inside, okay.
It's called Blasted. And that was my second trick. And how that came about was a very fine artist and magician called Eric Mason. And he actually designed this big contraption to do it. Mm-hmm. And then going home on the train with my father, who was a very clever man, and he said, I can do that. We get home, he gets a Simonized car polish tin lid.
Yeah.
And that worked.
Wow.
And so that was the... Now, how do you get all these lids?
Because it's Simonized, I guess you contacted the manufacturer.
Yeah, so we said, we're having a rag week, and we're going to have Boadicea, the lady with the big shield. And we want to nail all these lids to the float.
Yeah.
They sent me boxes on them. So they cost nothing.
Nothing, right.
And we... I brought it over to Tannen's. I don't know when I first came to Tannen's. And... Tannen said they would like to market it. I said, just mention my name. Just say Bob Swaddling, because I wanted my name to be known. Not,
sure.
I didn't want any money you could make yet, but it's mine.
Right.
No problem at all. Never put my name on it, and I was very, very... I was a little bit upset with that, but that's how magic... that's how magic is.
Yeah.
The flipper came about with Ken Brooks in a way. Ken Brooks wanted a folding coin with a shell over it. And he wanted a 3-cup.
Yeah.
So I made him one. And we're playing around. Because he wanted, you know, you can see the cuts, can't you? But when it has a shell on, you can't.
You can't, right. This guy's there.
And he wanted to take the shell off. Mm-hmm. And I got it jammed in there.
It wouldn't come off.
It wouldn't come out, really. But
even with a bang ring.
You know. Yeah. No, but I hit it like this, and it opened. Now I've got two coins.
Oh. And you're thinking, oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Your light goes on.
Oh,
yeah.
I like that. So I smiled, went away, and produced the flipper. And then I put a magnet in the flipper. And a magnetic coin, and it was sold. We sold it for years as Double Deception,
mm-hmm.
and
love that trick.
And so then things just what it was. I was a tool maker with the Atomic Energy Authority. I was an apprentice. I was poached by Oxford University to work in the nuclear physics department.
What was your background? Where did you study? What was your background?
I went to...
Were you an apprentice, a toolmaker?
Yeah, okay. I was Harwell, the Atomic Energy Authority, the craftsmen that were in the local area weren't up to making the high-quality apparatus that was needed. So they decided to recruit people and train us. 5-year apprenticeship.
Yeah.
At the end of it, if you weren't very good, you were a maintenance man.
Right.
If you were at top of it, you were a toolmaker. And I was a toolmaker. I was poached then by Oxford University to be a technician. And basically what that job was people who had got their degrees and were going for doctors, they were doing thesis and they wanted some special apparatus. So they would come down, do sketches of things that they want.
Right.
I'd say, oh, sure, no problem, and I'd make it. And they'd come down, say, oh, no, I want smoke to come out of here, and think, oh, no problem. Then when I really got the taste for manufacturing invention, I couldn't see any. I couldn't see. People would come to me and say, "Well, we." I couldn't see any problem with it. It was like big nothing.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So
they had the idea. You were able to just make it.
Yeah. I'll just make it. What do you want to do?
Sure.
And it's not being boastful, or I don't know, but I do have a curse that if I have, I'm thinking of something. I can't shut off. My brain, say like when I'm talking to you, if I've got something I'm working on, I'm really thinking as well about that. I can't switch off until that problem's solved. So it's there's only one thing I can do where it. I lived in Switzerland for 2 years, and I went skiing.
Yeah.
Now, skiing, when I get to the top and I'm coming down, all my brain is thinking of is, am I going to hit that tree? I hope that person moves out of the way. And when I get to the bottom, my brain has emptied.
Because you made it safely,
yeah,
right?
Do you know what I mean?
Sure, sure.
Very difficult to do.
And you're ready to go back up and do it again? Yeah.
But my kids said, when they ski down, they're skiing, wonderful skiers, they actually are talking. Well, what are we going to have for dinner? Are we going to go to a restaurant?
Yeah.
Not me.
Yeah.
I'm
you're focused on the little things.
I'm focused on getting to the bottom without killing myself.
Yeah.
And so they wanted me to have all these lessons and be a better skier. And I wouldn't, because I enjoyed so much the feeling of when I got to the bottom that my brain was...
unloaded finally, yeah.
All those things had unloaded. So that was just a...
Well, then you met, you know Mark Mason, I guess, from Blackpool, or did you not, or when did you...
No, I heard of Mark, and what happened was, he came down to see me. I lived 20 minutes from Mark, and he invited me up to his house. Now, Mark and Trish are wonderful people. I admire what I call grafters, that's people who work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, Mark's up at 5 in the morning and he doesn't finish till 8 making all his stuff.
Yeah.
And I went to his house. If you know Mark's background, I won't say much about it, but it was a tough upbringing.
Sure was.
And I went to his house. To me, from England, it was like a film star's place, overlooking this lake. He's got a boat.
Wow.
And it's just, to me, it was, And we sat there talking.
Mm-hmm.
He said, "Bob, I want to be honest with you. I've been ripping off your flipper coin for years."
Uh-huh.
He said, "We should be friends, and we got to put this to rest." So I said, "Okay." So what happened was, before I left England, I thought I'd pack it all in. And my family said, "If you do that, you'll die. You've got to have this magic in your life."
You've got to have it, right, yes.
Mm-hmm. So I said to Jamie Schoolcraft, and I wrote the tango, and I said, "Would you like the rights of my coin tricks?" I believe I'm the originator of the magnetic locking coin, the magnetic coins, the flipper coins, and Jamie Schoolcraft said yes.
Mm-hmm.
And checks in the post. That's as far as that got.
That's good.
Tango wrote me the most rude letter that I have ever had from anybody, saying how terrible a person I was and the thing, and he ripped off all my lines.
Because they thought that you were going to make a deal with them or something on it? Or?
Well, I wrote to Tango and offered him for a small sum of money the rights to the...
And they didn't take it?
No, he said, "Why should I? It's all in old books, and everybody's making it," which they are. That bit is true. Everybody ripped it off. And I said, "Well, do you want to be honourable about it?" And he said, "No, he didn't."
Wow.
Get stuffed, really.
Wow.
So I was a bit upset. So I'm telling Mark this. He said, "How much do you want, Bob?"
Yeah.
I said, "Well, it was only like $2,000.
Mm-hmm.
Mark gets up.
Yep.
Takes a shoebox, gives me $2,000.
And there you are.
And he owned the rights. So it doesn't mean anything. Everybody's still ripping it off. But yeah. Mark was the most ethical. And the same with... I did consulting work for Marvin's Magic in England.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And he took some of my lines, mm-hmm. and he paid me the royalties, and he acted very ethical. And so that really then was the start of...
your relationship with Mark.
With Mark.
Did you start making them for Mark then, or...? Or is Jamie making them? Who makes them, actually, physically?
No.
Makes them?
No, Mark has a very good mechanic in England who makes... non-silver items.
Yeah,
I make all Mark silver items.
Mm-hmm.
I was taught by... I won't bore you with this bit, but it is an interesting story.
Yeah, again, our next thing here in a few minutes.
Right, is the how to do expanded coins.
Hmm.
Nobody tells anybody how you do it.
Uh-huh.
We all lie and say, you do that? Yeah, I do that. and so it's a thing. And as I'm getting old, I said to Mark, I got high quality Swiss machines. If I die, what's going to happen to it all?
Yeah.
So he comes down for lessons, and I've taught Mark can expand coins.
Yeah.
Very good. And he can now do basic machining of certain tricks that he sells. Mm-hmm. He comes down and works. So I'm very happy that the skill and the knowledge...
has been passed on.
It's going to be passed on. And
that's
Mark's...
Great. So he was like your apprentice.
He's like my apprentice.
Sure.
I make him bring me an apple, you know, as a teacher. And but also yes. What I do for Mark is if he invents a trick, he's got no idea... Well, that's not quite true. It's a bit harsh. Of how to mass produce it.
Mm-hmm.
His methods are basic because he doesn't know.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I do also is I make the dies, the punches, the tooling,
right.
So that Mark, he has an easier life. He can bring in somebody who's, we call them monkeys, you know.
Yeah, to make
no,
them.
That's
yeah.
a bit harsh. And so they can produce the right. stuff efficiently.
Yeah. Well, you know, I would think in Florida, you live in a retirement community area, there'd be a lot of retired people who are looking for something to keep occupied and their hands busy, and they really don't need much income, and it'd just be monkey work. I would think it'd be easier to find.
It isn't because...
No?
It really isn't. I don't know why. We have found some companies who've got CNC machines and make things, but the big problem is that you can't buy the material from what the Chinese would make them.
No, that's a good point. They could always undercut you.
You know, so I want to give the work to the Americans.
Yeah,
you know,
keep it here.
The economy is tough and the thing, and so like my coin boxes. We had a company make those, and they want $200 an hour, a skilled person.
Uh-huh.
They're
sure.
It takes me, say, 3 hours to make something.
Yeah.
He isn't going to give me $300.
Yeah.
But he looks, Mark Mason and Trish are wonderful to me. They look after me because I'm a little old man and they carry my bags. And if I'm really in trouble, he's there to dig me out.
That's
so,
great.
That's the end of the talk because we've got to go.
I hear the whistle over there. One last thing, because this my podcast is called The Magic Word, then Bob, what would be your magic word? You know, something that you live by, your philosophy of life, perhaps?
Two things, not necessarily philosophy, but in magic.
Yeah, whatever.
I had a talk with Di Vernon about cups and balls.
Yeah.
Best bit of advice, and it doesn't just apply to the cups and balls, mm-hmm. is get to the fruit as quick as you can.
That makes sense, yeah. I understand exactly what you're saying.
Right.
That's what the people want to see.
You know, they don't want 2 hours. Well, magicians do, but to earn money, get to the... And that applies, I'm not going to mention the tricks that people did in the thing, but there are a lot of times in the shows I've seen where they could have got to the fruit quicker.
Yeah.
And also, the next piece of advice was from Ken Brooks. Never, ever get greedy with a principal. and you see people, say, using a holdout machine, and they'll do it 23 times, and that's greedy with a principle.
Yeah.
And so when I watch acts, how quick did they get to the fruit?
Yep.
And are they greedy with the principle?
Makes sense.
And some of the things I've watched here, those rules could apply.
Thank you, Bob. Thank you very much for your time. Appreciate it. That was Bob Swadling, Amber Scott Wells, and the Magic Word Podcast.com. Scotty out. Well, we just finished watching Danny DeOrtiz's fabulous lecture, and even though you understand how he does these things, there are some workable some material in there that's really good. It's just his psychology that he uses, his subtleties are very, very good. So I'm back on the lobby over here and visiting with our friend Harrison Carroll. Hi, Harrison.
Hi, how are you?
Doing great, thank you.
Great to see you, Scott.
You too, buddy. Every year over here. So you're from Buffalo.
Yes.
And so you've been coming to this since probably almost the first one. You kind of come in and out. Depends upon what your travel schedule is.
Yeah, when I was working, I really never missed one. A couple I might be here for a day, half a day. But now I'm here for all of it.
Yeah.
So I'm not working.
Kind of semi-retired.
Almost. That's a good way to put it.
Now, you've come up with a few ideas that you have marketed also. You know, what was the thing that, just a minute, with the numbers on the Plex?
Clearly predictable.
Clearly predictable,
yes.
Yeah, and I like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Very good effect.
It is a good effect.
Yeah. That's still selling?
We sold out.
Did you have many more sales?
No, it's a lot of work to me.
It is a lot of work.
Yeah.
I love it.
So, but we sold them. The last one, Paul called, I had one left, and Elmwood Magic called about a month ago.
Yeah.
And he says, I need that one you were holding back. So there's none
so
left.
That's it.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we shouldn't probably be promoting that if they're not available for sale. But
right.
Okay.
No, but it went well, and it's a good trick.
Now, you've been doing trade shows. Really, that's been your bread and butter for all of your life, pretty much? Or
30 years.
Yeah.
I mean, I had a real job prior to going into trade shows. One day I went home and told my wife I was quitting my job to become a magician.
And she said, no, really, what are you going to do?
Well, yeah, I wasn't even that nice.
Okay.
So, but it worked. I got lucky, it worked, and I made a living for 30 years.
Did you have a particular industry that you worked for, or at the beginning, did you kind of take everything and then start honing it down to a certain industry?
No, I never had a certain industry, but in the 90s, when the computer industry exploded, there was so much work. And they were throwing so much money away that dominated my work.
Yeah.
So it was 80% of my, it became 80% of my work.
Yeah.
But I did it all, I mean, in terms of industries, hard parts for automotive, trucking, medical, you name it. You know, I've done a lot of industries.
But you never really did the big illusions types of things, did you?
No.
You really just kind of...
Stand up, close up, you know. And actually, I was a close-up guy.
Right.
And I was forced into doing stand-up because some of the trade shows, they wanted you in a theater-style format where people are in chairs.
Sure.
So I brought my show up into the air to make it bigger and, and got into stand-up that way.
Because I know that Paul Gertner had done the same kind of thing, basically, but he also expanded that to do some larger illusions, you know, like with the origami.
Origami, yeah. Yeah, he did do some illusions, and...
But you never got into any of that?
I didn't. It's a whole... Now you're selling another product because you're going to charge more.
Right.
You know, because you've got more to handle.
That's
you've
right.
got to ship the thing and all this, so...
And assistance or whatever sometimes.
Yeah. So I never really got into that. Yeah, and I've hired assistants.
Yeah.
And just when I had to do stand-up, because now you can get them in the chairs without standing 20 feet away yelling, hey, come in, have a seat. Now you sound like a bitch, you know.
It's a jam auction.
You know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you travel all over the world? Or you made
I did.
Okay.
Sure.
What was one of the best engagements that you ever were come to mind? Location? Might have had to do with people you met? Show you did?
The
product
you
pushed?
Usually, if it depends, it's hard to say one.
Yeah.
But if I was working, you know, there was a time when Mark Phillips, Bill Goldman, Tim Conover, and I were doing like 6-7 shows a year.
Yeah.
So at night we'd hang out. There was this camaraderie and this friendship that developed from that by hanging out so much. And then there was I had a long run where, I mean, the Conover thing with Goldman and Phillips, that ran a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to that, in the early years, I was with Goldman, Whit Hayden, and Jerry Newton, and it was the same guys again.
Sure.
So we'd go out, hang out, talk magic, talk philosophy of magic, talk about how hard the day was. And that was really more fun than
Hanging out with the friends.
Being in a city. Because you could be in Paris, and what do you see? You're working all day, you go eat, you go back to your room.
Can't go to the museum, everything's closed by that time.
You really don't see anything.
Well, in some of those cases, did you come early, stay late?
No, because usually I took magic as this is your product.
Yeah.
So I got to get home, get back at the office.
Start working on the next
one. Start working on the, finishing the, you know, the paperwork on the last one. Work on the next one. Work on all your correspondence back then. You didn't have email and stuff.
Right. Let me ask you that when you're working on these different contracts, there are a couple different schools of thought and philosophy. I'd like to know what yours is as to charging, whether that you include the cost of your flight and hotel in there, like all one lump sum price, or you split it out and then invoice them and say, okay, well, it's going to be, or else you get a per diem or whatever. How did you...
Well, for my whole career, I charged expenses, travel, lodging, and meals.
Mm-hmm.
And if a client was, a little timid because that was a questionable number, I'd say, hey, you're sending your staff. You kind of got an idea what it costs for somebody to go out of town. It's the same.
Right.
Then toward the end of my career, I did shift to just a slam dunk flat fee.
Yeah.
Because I had so many free miles and so many free hotels, I could book the show and
extra money.
Use the freebies.
Sure.
So, but at the end of my career, I did that.
Mm-hmm.
I went with the flat fee.
Yeah, I found that it seems like it's better that way, and you don't have to keep stringing it along and say, okay, well, here's another invoice that I've got. Well, I'm going to get this back or whatever.
Well, my initial thought was, at the time I started, I thought, wow, I'm charging these people a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm going back to 82 or 83. I think I was charging like $2,500 for a show.
Yeah.
I thought it was a lot of money then. But so I wanted to break it up so it didn't look so big. So I would ask for a deposit of half and say balance to be invoiced upon completion.
Okay.
And it also gave me another reason to talk to the client.
Mm-hmm.
Because as you're building a client base, you need to have that interaction and a reason to talk to them and to cement the relationship.
Right.
So that you can have an ongoing long-term situation rather than just you're a vendor, you sold something, they bought it, and it's done.
Right.
I wanted to erase that mentality if I could.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another reason I opted to go with the straight expenses. Because Eddie Tullock used to charge a per diem.
Yes.
And that was it.
Mm-hmm.
And he used to tell me, no, you got to charge a per diem. I go, no, I got another reason, so that's why.
What about Dietrich, do you recall?
No, I never really.
Or Mike?
Mike Rogers did the same as Tullock, and so did Dick Rye. And so I'm assuming.
Some of the old guys.
Dietrich might have done the same with the per diem.
That was the way it was, and then maybe with.
It might have been the way it was. But I just thought businesses at the time, my thinking was, oh, they're used to expenses. They understand it. They have employees.
Expense counts, right.
So they get the idea they got to pay to get you there, and pay to feed you, and pay to put you in a hotel.
Well, a lot of times that you want to be in the same hotel. At least I do. I want to be in the same location with those guys so that way I can take the shuttle or the ride with them or whatever and come and go, and also, if you want, go out to dinner or whatever with them.
And 90% of the time it works. If it's a late booking, the hotel may not have rooms available and they stick you somewhere else. But if you book it early enough, plus most of the companies, you're in a very nice hotel.
Right.
You're in a high-end hotel.
Yeah.
A few times I had companies that... I'll give you a good example. A Fortune 500 company.
Yeah.
Quaker State at the time. Stated they were the nicest people. And they treated me great. But the guy that booked the hotels booked the lowest end hotels.
Okay.
And you'd get in, you'd feel kind of sleazy, yeah. And I'd say, Bill, why do you book? Why don't you stay at like the Hyatt or something? He goes, hey, all you do is sleep there. But that was his attitude. It wasn't even the money.
Yeah.
I mean, it was. He thought it was a waste of money because you're just sleeping there. But when you're on the road, as you know, Scott, you're this is home.
Yeah.
When you open that door and drop your suitcase, this is your home.
For a number of hours, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And for me, at night and in the morning, it's home. You want it comfortable and you want it clean. And
you don't want to worry about bed bugs or crack deals going down in the driveway.
Yeah, just you don't even want the visual feeling of something that's decrepit.
Yeah.
You know, because you're getting dressed nice, you want to feel nice, look nice, and that contributes to that.
Well, not only that, but the all the larger corporations, of course, have their own travel department, so they can arrange for your flights then as well.
Right.
To say, hey, why don't you just handle all that, here's my fee, you know.
Right.
I'll fly with your guys, your convenience, stay in the hotel, and you just arrange for that.
And I did that for years until I started realizing maybe 87, 88 maybe. Wow, look at all these programs.
Yeah.
And I'm flying all these different airlines. I'd be better off being in control of the airline.
Yeah.
Because you get the elite status, then you're up front all the time, and you get the benefits of that. So I started telling them, I'll book the airline.
Right.
You take care of everything else. You know, because you need that elite status back then when you were flying all the time.
And in the early days, again, you were talking about Mike Rogers and Mark Phillips and Bill Goldman, all the guys. It seems like there was just a handful of guys, maybe a dozen or so, who were doing it on a full-time, regular basis. And I would think that would be harder to break into at that time because that market was wrapped up by the handful of guys.
Well, people didn't know about it.
But
even know about the market, really.
Yeah.
Magicians didn't.
Yeah.
This whole idea of corporate.
Carol Fox wasn't an early guy.
Carol was early.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there were a number of early guys, but they didn't talk about it.
Yeah.
And you didn't know the market was out there.
Right.
So now everybody knows about it, and it's like the giant pie, and it's getting cut smaller and smaller and smaller.
Sure.
And companies even didn't know about there were things like us out there. So you almost had to picture the idea in their mind as you talked to them to get them to try it. And then once you got them to try it, you could be with them for years.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Whereas today, it's tough to have a client for year after year after year. Cause
it is. A lot of times they want to try something new or go in a different direction, then you're trying to have to repitch that again for the next year.
Yeah, and it's like, this works.
Rebundle this. Yeah,
this is so powerful. Why do you want to change it?
Yeah.
But, you know, I think the way people's jobs are structured and how they have to report puts them in a position where they think they have to make a change all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, you might get 2-3 years now. It's tough to get I've had 17-year clients.
Mm-hmm.
And those days, you know, even what the guys that are working a little bit today are talking, it doesn't happen.
No, not really. A few years ago, 3 years ago or four, it seems like, I remember talking to Paul Gertner about that, about, you know, some client that he'd been working for, and he said, hey, we're done. You know, I mentioned, thank you very much. And it's nothing about you. It's just, you know, the general economy and our business, et cetera. And one of the other guys sitting around, you know, was saying, well, who is that? And he told him, and he said, good luck. If you can book it, fine. He says, they're just not doing anything. You
know, right.
It's not a matter of me versus you.
Right.
You know, so I think that was just kind of...
Or, you know, the guy will call on him, and they'll say, oh, we had a magician. It was great.
Yeah.
Then why aren't you doing it?
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Then that's why I'm calling. Yes, if it's great, let's do it again.
Yeah,
seems like they're trying to do things. So which direction do you think that the trade show... magic, if at all, it's going to be
a lot of people say it's had its day, it's never going to be like it was, and they may have some...
There's still trade shows, though.
Right, and people who sell things need to get in front of other people. This is just my perspective. So that means there's always going to be a trade show, and whenever there's a trade show, there's going to be a need for a company to stand out on the show floor.
And attract
traffic. And get their message out.
Yes.
So I think how we sell it is the new... the new road. The way I sold doesn't work today.
Well, how did you do it before?
I knocked on doors. When I started without one client, I cold called. Mm-hmm. And I called. And I kept saying, all I want is one client. If it takes me 3 months.
Yeah.
And that was my attitude. I want one client.
How did you go about that? I mean, like three or four people a day? Or did you have like a goal?
I called on the phone all day long. And I had a tickler file.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And until I could get an appointment, and I would go in, and then I would have a, I would go back a second time after during the first call. I would say, "I'd like to come back. Purely speculative on my part. Won't cost you a dime.
Yeah.
I'll put together a 5-minute example of what we're talking about,
mm-hmm.
and I'll come back and do it for you." But the person who can say no to this going forward has to be here.
Yeah.
Not the person who can say yes, because you'd have higher ups who go, "No, I don't want to do that," and it's dead.
Right.
And they weren't in the room. So,
oh, that's interesting. So you want to have the no's, not the yes.
Yeah.
Huh.
So I, a lot of people could say yes, but there's somebody that can squash it and say no.
Interesting philosophy. Okay.
So I started doing that, and I picked up a client. I picked up another client.
That's what Walter Blaney told me, that he went around in Houston and different places, and he was doing the vanishing birdcage, door to door. He'd be going to a building, just knock on one door, go to the next door, you know, and just kind of going around. He said, "I did that vanishing birdcage."
It took a long time. I would say in about 3 years, I had about 8 clients, and I was calling every day, nonstop.
Yeah.
So, but 8 clients, I could make a living.
Yeah.
And, of course, when you're out and you're working, you're getting leads. It gets easier.
That's right.
You don't have to cold call anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But you got to follow up on those leads you got when you were working.
Yeah.
Right? So you're still selling. You're just not cold calling.
Mm-hmm.
Well, today, everything's voicemail. Mm-hmm. How do you get through to the secretary? There is no secretary. The guy could be sitting there listening to the voicemail.
That's right.
So the Internet's a big force in marketing today. It's also expensive to market on the Internet if you don't know what you're doing.
True. You have a slick video.
You have to have a real good video, and you have to penetrate the online public in such a way that you're targeting the people you want to see,
mm-hmm.
and that just, there's a way to do that, I understand, but it's not easy. I mean, you almost have to become a internet marketing expert.
Or pay thousands and thousands. Yeah.
But you just can't knock on doors anymore.
Hmm.
It's no longer the easy way to get there.
So again, that there will continue to be trade shows, but it's just a matter of how to reach the person who is going to ultimately sign your contract.
That's what I think, yes.
Yeah, to see that and appreciate that. Because I think as some of these younger people have grown up, that they saw magic as children and are thinking perhaps of, you know, tricks are for kids and not for adults, and so it's still kind of a hard nut to crack.
Mm-hmm.
Even when
you're making the phone calls back in my day,
yeah.
It was a hard nut to crack. I mean, after all those years, I only had 8 clients.
Yeah.
What kind of salesman could stay in business?
Yeah.
That's because it's a hard, it's a difficult thing to sell.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, once you get it, you can be there a long time.
Sure.
But now you don't even have that, so you got to use something else to sell it. You got to use something else, and that's the Internet,
yeah.
I think. So,
and it'll probably be something else after this. I mean, that's currently the thing. It probably will be for a number of years.
I think so. So to get back to the original point, there's business out there. It's just the magicians aren't doing the right things to get the business. I mean, that's my motto or attitude. So it's not that, oh, the industry crashed. There's an industry out there, but we're doing the wrong things to get the business.
You were talking about a piece of the pie, and Coaster Kimball had made a point a while back. He said, "I don't see that we are in competition with each other. You know, that it's not a matter of the pie being so large and we're getting smaller and smaller pieces of it." He said, "Just think of it as a bigger pie."
Mm-hmm.
He said, "Whenever I fly back home, and as I'm landing in the airport, I see all these buildings around there. I look at each of these buildings thinking each of those places has different companies and different departments. Every one of them is a potential client."
Mm-hmm.
"So just look at it as a bigger piece of pie, you know, I mean, a bigger pie,
uh-huh.
but you can still get that same piece, you know."
Right.
And so the business, I think, is still out there. It's a matter of trying to work as hard as you did before in order to get that.
Yeah,
but
people
in a different
think
way.
It's not your show that's going to. Well, you have to have a good show, of course, but
you have to know business.
You better approach it, I think, as this is your business. Treat it like one. Be a businessman. Don't just be a magician, because
they're not coming to see tricks.
Right.
Yeah. People who are coming to the trade shows are coming around for specific reasons, to buy or to learn about certain products or whatever, and you're just trying to pass on that message for that service or product or whatever.
Right. So when you sell it to that client, they're more comfortable if they know this is a business and you're a businessman with a product.
And you are a salesman for them. You're mm-hmm. not a magician for them. You're a salesman for them.
Right.
Yeah. That's the big key, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
You have to sell that, that part of it. And that's what's going to be the tight wire to walk when you're trying to promote yourself on YouTube or your website or whatever else, so that it's not like so much mystery as it is that
right.
you have a good corporate image. You look good, your pictures, and everything is slick.
And I always took that road in my promotional material and even on my internet presence. I didn't really care what the magicians thought. I only cared because they weren't writing the checks. They weren't writing the checks.
That's right.
So I went after the what a corporate mentality would think. And I always thought in those terms.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Put yourself in the place of the person who's writing the check. Would you write a check for yourself?
You know? Right, right, right.
Would I hire me?
Yeah, I know. That's a good way to think of it.
If I wanted to have a successful company,
but a lot of magicians need to know and understand what the company needs.
Yeah.
Not what somebody told them the company needs.
Right.
Because I've heard a lot of young guys just regurgitate, oh, I'm going to pack your booth.
No. Don't guarantee that.
You know, first of all, what does the company need to achieve at that show? You know, you got to ask some questions.
Oh, yeah.
What do you hope to get out of this show?
Why are you here? What did you do last year? How much you plan on spending?
Yeah.
How much you expect to get out of it? Yeah.
So
it's a basic question.
Yeah, exactly.
Not like, hey, let me show you. Pick a
card. I know. People. Yeah, I know. So anyway, that's that.
Ah, interesting. Well, thank you. Let's go back. Well, I've got you over here and talk about Buffalo and that Eddie Fechter. What was since this was Fechter's Finger Flicking Frolic and Eddie died back in the 70s over there? What kind of a guy was he?
I loved Eddie. I just loved him, and it's such a gift that I have having had the opportunity to see him.
Of all these guys here, you know, you're one of the few people, it seems like, who really go back and knew him, you know.
There's a few. Larry Martinez, Vic Tribuco, Carl Norman, who may or may not be here tomorrow. Gene Protas may have known Eddie.
Yeah.
There's a few, certainly Obie, of course, Mike Hilberger. There's quite a few here that remember.
Quite a few, but there's still more than a dozen people or so, you know.
Yeah, maybe
a dozen.
I've
been coming for 30 years, and I didn't know him.
Well, I think he died in 79. He died in 1979.
Mm-hmm.
And every year, Rob Allen, Paul Richards, Mike Siege, and I go to his grave.
Mm-hmm.
Haven't missed a year. Well, they came later, Paul and Mike.
Yeah.
But now, usually around the time he died, we go to his grave, clean it up, take care of it. Because he gave us so much.
Yes.
It was just wonderful.
Give me a story or two that you might remember from him or something where he was entertaining one of the people at the Forks, or
he had so many bits.
Yeah,
I mean, he had a. You got to remember, this is a different era.
Yeah,
he's an old bar guy from the old bar days, and the mentality of the public was different in the '60s and the '50s.
Yeah,
so some of the humor was more crass than would be acceptable today.
Right. Certainly, nothing political.
You know, but I mean, he had lines and bits like a woman would walk in. He goes, "Is that a cashmere sweater?" And she'd say, "No." He goes, "Oh, because of the humps." Or a camel hair sweater,
because of the humps.
Yeah, but or else he'd be pouring somebody's beer, and he'd pull the glass away.
Yeah.
And the beer would fall, and he'd grab a rag and goes, "Let me clean that up for you." You know, things like that. He had all these bits. The Eskimo peeing, you probably heard that.
Guys.
You know, so.
Well, no, they have it. Tell that one.
Oh, he like if you were in this hotel and he walked by an ice machine, he'd get a pocket full of ice, and a little while later he'd come down here. Now nobody knows he was there. He'd say, "Did you ever see an Eskimo pee?" And he'd unzip his zipper and he'd have the ice pop and he'd like let it fall out in ice cubes. But he would do it in the bar, you know.
Yeah.
Very funny guy.
Jay, man.
Well, let me ask. Well, just starting to just wrap up, you know, over here then, too. Let me just ask you, since the name of the podcast is called The Magic Word, what is your magic word? Not necessarily something that you would, you know, use in the context of magic like abracadabra, but it might be a philosophy of life or something that you live by or a code or ethics or something that comes to mind.
Be true to yourself.
True to yourself. Be true to yourself.
And that's about, as Shakespeare said, then thou canst not be false to any man. So
very good. Harrison Carroll, that was great. Thank you very much. A lot of really great advice there. I hope you guys tuned to that. And we'll talk to you later. Thanks,
right,
Harrison. Take care.
Scott,
Harrison,
you're
Carroll.
Welcome.
Scotty out. All right, well, just I'm finishing up over here with Harrison, then Mike Siege comes up. Hey there, Mike.
Hi, how are we doing?
We're doing great, thank you. I appreciate, first of all, you giving me a ride from the airport.
Anytime.
That's great. And you're a Buffalo magician doing full-time magic, the only full-time magician, actually, in Buffalo?
Rob and Carol Allen are out of Niagara Falls, but Buffalo, New York, I mean, I perform for a living. Everything from corporate to I have a school assembly show that I do, and I do 5 restaurants throughout the week.
Now, when you're doing the restaurants, are they family restaurants? Are they Brass and Fern, steak places?
Four of the places are family restaurants. Actually, the fifth place is a family restaurant, too, but for the fifth place, it's more of like an Irish pub, so I'm behind the bar a lot there, and I do a lot of
bar magic
stuff. Yeah,
then,
absolutely.
Too? Do you serve drinks, or are you kind of like a...
No.
Just
strictly magic, and I bounce from behind the bar to the tables. I go back and forth.
Gotcha. So you're not serving beers and okay. Now, do you just kind of show up, or do you work in like a set time, like 7 to 9?
Oh, it's a set time every night. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday are 5 to 8, and then the Saturday night gig is 6 to 9. And I have a couple guys that fill in for me. Like, obviously, you know Mike Hilberger. Yeah. Todd Nelson's another guy that fills in for me. Those are, you know, great Buffalo guys, and they fill in a lot. As a matter of fact, the one place I'm at Saturday nights, you know, with my private shows, I do between 400 to 500 shows a year. With my private shows, my Saturdays, I think I was only there like 18 times last year on a Saturday. So those guys do fill in a lot, but there's always someone at the restaurant. If I can't make it, someone will be there.
Yeah, and you also use the restaurants as a springboard or a place to kind of practice.
Absolutely.
And make new contacts.
Absolutely. Every single table that I go to, they get all my cards. They get promotional material. I try to engage as much as possible to find out who am I actually dealing with when I walk up to a table. Perhaps they might be on a PTO. Perhaps they might work at a company, be a salesperson. I can talk to them about sales meetings or trade shows and stuff like that. I always try to not just walk up and do the magic, but actually engage in conversation with them and talk to them about who they are. Yeah.
Yeah. So you're not just walking up and doing tricks. You are trying to use that as a marketing tool. I'm here in order to see what I can do for you.
Absolutely. And I try to do that right off the bat. And the reason that I do that, at least I find, is if I walk up to a table and it's and they have some, like, let's say they have children at the table, but they happen to be the vice president of a company or a sales leader for their company. What I'll do is I might not necessarily cater to the kids. Well, I still will do magic for the kids, but I might not cater to them. I'll cater more towards what I would do in a corporate setting, and then give them my card at the end and say, this might work out great for, something you have coming up.
Right.
So that's what I try to, right off the bat, find out who I'm dealing with instead of just walking up and doing my stuff.
That's a good idea. I've always found, like in family restaurants, of entertaining the children first, because they're the ones who are antsy, and sometimes they're the ones who say, hey, there's a magician, and so they're the ones who talk to parents into coming in. So they need to be entertained first, and then you go to the invisible deck or whatever else, for the parents.
Absolutely. I find a lot of people will say, kid magic, or I don't do kid shows or anything else, and I find that is incredibly foolish. I find that as a matter of fact, I was reading your lecture notes yesterday, and there's a quote in there that says, the more, I forgot exactly how it went, but it was the more rounded you are, the more bookings you will get. And I wanted to tell you when I saw you today.
Oh, thank you.
That is 100, I agree with that 100%. The more well-rounded you are, being able to adapt to any situation, the more bookings you will get. And especially in Buffalo, which is a very small city, you have to do everything. You have to do corporate. You have to do kids stuff, whether it be a first communion party, you have or school assembly. Anybody that says, "Oh, I just do this," especially in a small city like Buffalo, I think they're lying. I think they're. That's
there's
not
no
true.
Way to be a full time. You can kind of do it occasionally for fun if you want to make a little bit of spending cash.
Yeah. I mean,
you got a family to feed.
Exactly. I mean, and if you are, you know, unless your wife has a fantastic job where you can only go out once every couple months, then. You know, but I'm out there every single night doing my stuff, and that's why I only make it up to Fectors on Friday and Saturday, because during the week I'm booked. So
right now, you also had worked with Paul Richards, Elmwood Magic. There,
used to work for Paul for many years at the Elmwood Magic. Yep.
And he's one of the few brick-and-mortar shops still around.
Actually, Paul switched all over to mail order now.
Online?
Online. With the products that he manufactures, I think the demand for them and the amount of time that he takes to make those products and everything, and I think that has really taken away from his ability to spend, you know, with customers in a brick and mortar shop, which is a good thing for him. I mean, you know, that's great for his business, and his products are dynamite. As a guy that works, I can tell you, I use almost every single thing that he has when I work. It's all working stuff.
Commercial and good stuff.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things, Mike, I want to talk with you about, since we're here at Fectors, is Fector himself, Eddie Fector. So,
yes.
And something that Harrison had just alluded to is going to the gravesite and everything with you and Paul, I guess. Paul
and Rob Allen from Niagara Falls. You know, I was 4 years old when Eddie passed away, so I never had a chance to meet him. But from all the stories from Rob and from Harrison, guys that were with him and guys that took care of him, and then after Eddie passed away, took care of Evelyn, and the stories are just phenomenal. It's one of those things where I say, man, I wish I was, you know, 30 years older just so I could have experienced that stuff.
Yeah. You were born in the wrong time.
Yeah, exactly. And I've been very, very fortunate to be friends with actually all three of those guys. You know, anytime I have a question about corporate or anything like that, Harrison is a phone call away, and he will, you know, he's an open book to me. He's really helped me out. And the same thing with Rob when it comes to performing or business questions. Rob has been absolutely phenomenal. I mean, these guys are like, they're like my magic fathers. I respect them and appreciate them so much. And I should also say Carol, too. Carol is Rob's wife. She is, she's just as much part of that team as Rob is.
Yeah.
So,
But then Eddie's wife, tell me about that. You know, you had
I got into collecting a few years ago, and I was just collecting just some, you know, older posters, some Carter, some Raymonds and stuff, and when you go over to Rob's house, Rob is like the collector. I mean, he's got everything, and he has a bunch of all this stuff from Fector, a lot of the pictures and a lot of the artifacts that were around the bar at the Old Forks. So every year, I'm very honored to go to the gravestone with Rob and Harrison and Paul, and we clean it out, and then we all go out and have breakfast, and it's great for Paul and I, especially because we sit back and we listen to those two guys talk, and every year it's a different story. Ah, man, I can't believe it's been, you know, 30 years since he passed away. Remember this? Remember at his funeral? Remember this? And you listen to these stories, and it's almost like you were there.
There, yeah.
And, you know, I appreciate that. And Rob, from going over to his house so many times and seeing all those artifacts, he started to give me some stuff. And the one day after we were over there, he gave me all these... all the knickknacks and all the artifacts that were behind the bar. He gave me the flag that was on Eddie's coffin. He gave me the pictures that were all throughout the Forks, not just magic pictures, but personal photos too of Eddie and Evelyn. When Eddie used to wrestle, and when Eddie would do tattoos in the army, and all these pictures. And he gave me the kitchen chair. Everybody knows the stories. If you hear one story about the Forks, is that after all the customers would leave, the magicians would go into the kitchen. Evelyn would cook them breakfast, and you know, the magicians would all sit around and fool each other. And the kitchen chair that Eddie used to sit on, I have in my house. The close-up table that every single magician that has attended this convention has performed on is sitting in my house, and it's just amazing. It's amazing. I have the very first. I have all of Eddie's SAM and IBM cards. I have his the very first Fector shirt and his registration. You know, from the 4F convention. So that's really cool for me to have that stuff. I know a lot of people look at it like, you know, my wife sometimes looks at it and goes, eh. But to me, I mean, especially because I'm a Buffalo guy, to keep that tradition alive.
Sure.
And every night I'm at a restaurant, someone will say to me, hey, we used to go to this place, and it was a long time ago, and it's just great to be able to talk about the folks. I really wish that I was there in its heyday. So that's that.
Good. Thank you, Mike. I appreciate it very much. Some good stories. Good information there then, too. All right. That was Mike Siege. Oh, by the way, let me ask you your magic word, since it's the Magic Word Podcast. You know, like, not necessarily abracadabra, what do you live by? What's your philosophy? What's your magic word?
I don't know if I have one.
Something that's important to you.
Something that is important to me.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm gonna have to get back to you on that. I think I really will have to get back to you on that one.
You're just wandering aimlessly through life. Is that what you're doing right now?
Exactly.
No focus.
Just trying to make it to tomorrow. So
okay. With the family. Okay. Great, Mike. Thanks very much. That was Mike Siege. This is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. Scotty out.
Come out.